Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Dukmasova, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time in the Ben Jarofsky Show. As I speak, it is Thursday, December 2nd, 2021. The headline that I'm reading is not from today. It's from a week ago. Stephen Sondheim, Titan of the American Musical, is dead at 91. I saw that headline in last Friday's New York Times. And immediately knew I wanted to do a show about Stephen Sondheim. I know everybody thinks of me as a political reporter and a sports junkie, but I am a huge fan of musicals, Broadway theater, and Stephen Sondheim in particular. Although I have to admit, I get a kind of kick out of just reading his lyrics almost as much as I enjoy listening to. They read really well, folks. If I could just urge you to Stephen Sondheim to read his lyrics sometime. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself, as I do with all distinguished guests, because I think I tracked down the person best to talk about Stephen Sondheim with in the entire city of Chicago. So, distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is William Brown, and I'm a Chicago actor, director, sometimes writer, sometimes teacher. I've been lucky enough to be a part of, I don't know, 8 or 9 different, Stephen Sondheim productions, both as actor and director. And I know I'm a lucky boy because of that.
All right. Bill, why don't we start with a personal thought, and, could go two ways with my first question. It could either be the significance of, Stephen Sondheim, into the history of American musicals and theater, or the significance of Stephen Sondheim to a man who has spent his entire adult life in theater. So why don't we go with that? Sir, what is the significance of Stephen Sondheim to you, and how did you find your way to him? We'll start with that.
The first I ever heard of Stephen Sondheim, I grew up in a small town in West Virginia, a long time ago, and there weren't really many opportunities to see any Stephen Sondheim, but I read about him. I read, he was covered in Time and Newsweek, and somehow I got a copy of a record, we called them then, of A Little Night Music, and I think I wore a hole in it. I hadn't seen it. It was years before I saw it. In point of fact, I don't think I ever saw it before I directed it. And I got the opportunity at Writers Theater in the middle iteration of the theaters in Glencoe, at the Women's Library Club. And, I was lucky. I'd been thinking about it for decades. Just from this teenager listening to this record. So I did the play in my head, in my memory, in my imagination. I was very fortunate to have extraordinary artists, actors, singers, musicians, designers to help me along the way. The space was ideal. It was 100 seats, and we did it acoustically. Nothing was amplified. We had a lovely little orchestra. The only requirement I had when we met with the designers was I had to have a harp, and we were glad that happened. But because the actors and the musicians had to play with each other, for reals, I think you heard every word. And because the actors didn't have to pump it up for the second or third balcony, they could just live in it. I had seen the Bergman film, Smiles of a Summer Night, and that was in the mix of what I thought this thing was. But they could do, they could be that. They could just be these characters. And it was a wonderful experience for all of us. They still have a Facebook page in which everybody keeps in touch. But it was as complete an experience I think I've had in the theater.
So when an actor is performing in a production like a Stephen Sondheim production, is it just a gig, a way to do your, display your gift, make some money doing it? Or do you as an actor realize how significant and how powerful this lyricist, this composer is?
I have never met any actor or designer or music. I've never met anyone who's done a Sondheim play who didn't know how lucky they were. That this is not a gig. Don't tell producers, but we'd probably do it for free. I mean, much has been said about his strengths, and then there's opposing camps of his weaknesses. I don't see the weaknesses. I of course he's an extraordinarily gifted lyricist. He started there, but his music, I mean, some of it just gets in your soul. As those actors came out in Times Square last week and sang the finale to Act One of Sunday in the Park with George. Well, I was in that production at the Goodman Theater, the old Goodman Theater, underneath the Art Institute. First day of rehearsal, we went upstairs and just stood around and looked at the painting. That infected that production. We knew how special this was. And when it came to that particular number where we put together the painting, I don't know how I managed it. I wanted to cry. I always had goosebumps. As we moved about and started to make the painting happen somewhere around, and parasols, bum, 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 bum. And it gently takes you to this declaration on an ordinary Sunday. Ba, 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 ba. I mean, it just, I don't know how I managed it, but somehow I did, because we do. But to hear all those performers standing there in Times Square, and I talked to some too who were there, and they said, I didn't sing, I was crying. You can't say this man is just, it's about his intellect. His heart and soul are in there too.
Well, let's talk a little bit about something that may affect his heart and soul. And this is from the obituary in the New York Times. And I will now read this to you and then get your thoughts. And this is about his relationships with his mother. And so you know this. Stephen Sondheim was an only child. His parents divorced. And mostly he was raised by his mother, well-to-do, New York City. And here's what the New York Times obituary had to say. In the years following his parents' separation, Mr. Sondheim recalled for his biography, his mother treated him precisely as she had her husband, flirting with him sexually on the one hand, belittling him on the other. As an adult, Mr. Sondheim supported her financially. Nonetheless, in the 1970s, the night before she was to have heart surgery, She wrote a letter to her son and had it hand-delivered. It read in part, quote, "The only regret I have in life is giving you birth," end of quote. I read that, Bill, in the obituary, and I'm like, how the hell could this guy move on with life? You know, that kind of like psychological crippling by a parent was probably going on his entire life. And I'm wondering if when you think back, having heard that, and you can think about the lyrics, the music, the shows, the Sondheim shows, do you think that you're seeing the impact of that kind of, I don't know what you call it, brutal parenting that he was subjected to?
Yeah, there is always pain. There is always pain. There is always hurt. It does not mean he's not without joy, and it certainly doesn't mean he's not without hope. I might be alone in this. I don't find his work as cynical as some people think it is, because I feel like, you know, interestingly, the first actual Sondheim I did, I was in college in West Virginia, and somehow, and it wasn't long after the first production of Follies in New York, right? Was it maybe a couple years after that? And it was a production of Follies. I think about it now, all us college kids. And of course, because I was tall and had a low voice, I played Ben. I played one of the four older people that have younger lives in the play. And it's bleak. It's dark. But everyone is looking for something to hang on to, whether it's each other or a dream or an idea, and that it's probably one of his darkest plays, and yet it's got some of the most fun music in it, the recreation of all those Follies numbers. I guess I could be way wrong, because I find cynicism boring and useless. So I don't see it in his work. Feel free to argue. But because there's always, no matter where someone goes, and he did the lyrics for Gypsy. There's a mother. Maybe that's where that mother came from. Now that I'm hearing this quote. But, you know, I mean, she's, it's easy to call her a monster. But that big number they give her, in which, you know, every woman who plays Mama Rose, you know, makes her mark, is monstrous and thrilling and so sad. You know, she never got the break her daughter did. Yes, everyone involved in that, the playwright, the composer, the actors have helped to create that, but his lyrics lead me to believe that he is not writing her off. He needs you to know who she is, what she needs, and how it didn't work out for her.
I am going to politely disagree with you a little bit, push back
okay.
on the issue of cynicism and Sondheim. And Gypsy is my favorite. He didn't write the music, but as I said, I'm in love mainly with the lyrics of Sondheim. I have to say, I just like reading them sometimes. But I had just been randomly, as preparation, going through some Sondheim lyrics to share them with you and get your thoughts of them. And there's one absolutely delightful lyric that I completely forgot. And it's from one of the most well-known Sondheim songs, or well-known Sondheim works, I should say, West Side Story, which I've seen like 452 times. I don't know if I could see it again, but I probably will see the Steven Spielberg movie that's coming out. Sondheim himself said it's a good movie. So, okay, if it's good for him, I'm going to go see it. But it's the song America. And if this isn't cynical, but in such a delightful way, Bill, it's like sneak cynicism. So here's the song. I'm going to read it. I'm not going to sing it. Unlike Bill, I cannot sing. If we played the music, we'd probably be sued by the Sondheim estate. And if I were to sing it, I would be charged with assault with a deadly weapon, which is my voice. So I'm just going to read the lyric. I like to be in America. Everything okay by me in America. Everything free in America for a small fee in America. I read that. I'm like, oh, my God. Everything's free in America for a small fee in America. It doesn't get much more cynical than that, Bill. Go ahead.
Okay, I will. What mitigates it is the music. It is a ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-da-bum-bum-bum-ba-ba-da-bum-bum-bum-bum. It allows, I mean, and comedy can transform cynicism, I want to believe, because that's funny. It's also sad, but at first it's funny. And it allows us to laugh at the cleverness of the put down, but I don't find that a cynical song. I feel it's damning. Cynical to me means dismissing something to the point of it's hopeless, and that music isn't hopeless.
I think that's actually a very valid point. In other words, well, first of all, just one more time, he did not write the music to that song. Leonard Bernstein did.
No, but they were working together.
They were working together, yeah. God, what a, just imagine what that was like, Bill, if he could be a fly on the wall. But I think, yes, upon reflection, the line itself is cynical, but it's embedded mm-hmm. in a larger song that's filled with hope. And the hope is carried by the yes. music. And yeah, so yes, the transformation, the adjustment of somebody who moved from Puerto Rico to New York City is difficult and challenging. And there are many disappointments along the way, but there's still this sense of hopefulness and optimism and belief that a dream can be realized. But he just drops that little line in there just to let you know he knows how the game is really going down. You follow what I'm saying?
He does. You know, I've directed Romeo and Juliet, I think, 3 times. And I've done a couple of school, productions for the tour to schools or, you know, schools, educational productions for the schools. And I love doing that. But I always want to laugh because it's like, okay, so you want us to bring in this play about sex, drugs, and suicide, right? That's what you know we're doing. And they don't see it that way. They never do, or rarely do. I did do a production a few years back in Montana, and there was one small town that had in their school a number of teen suicides that year. And they asked us not to come that year, and we fully understood why. But like West Side Story, it at the heart of the play is these two young people who love each other despite society, despite their parents, despite everything, and play it out to the end and you know, you always have to find, you can't let them know they're going to die at the end, even though everybody knows they die at the end. But you fight not to, to make them forget, to make the audience forget that.
Let me go through a few more songs and get your response or reaction to them. And they're very well known. Obviously, you've directed them, sung them, listened to them. One is Send in the Clowns, which is perhaps is, I don't know, I probably the only Sondheim song that was a pop hit. Judy Collins recorded it in the 70s, and it was a pop hit. I'm not sure certain if any of other of his songs were turned into popular hits that made it on the radio, et cetera, and so forth. And so this is a song where it's about missed romantic chances, and the character who sings it is an aging actress. So it's kind of like a play on missing out on love, and also reading your stage notes about entering when you enter the stage in a theater. Okay, here we go. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again was with my usual flair. Some of my lines, sure of my lines, no one is there. Boy, did I butcher that. But no one is there. And talk a little bit about that. It's just such a powerful lyric, Bill.
It's so powerful. It's so powerful. And you know, it didn't have to do anything because she'd done the play in front of it. You know what I mean? It was very, this is a woman who knows who she is at a moment in her life, more at this moment than any other moment in her life. And what she's discovered she wants, needs, isn't available. And the song does not insist, the song does not, the music doesn't berate or mourn. It's in 3/4 time, like the whole show. And yet there's an unbearable sadness in it. And part of what makes it land for me is her conscious ability to be in front of it, ending with, well, maybe next year. It's unbearable. and a terrific actor or singer. And interestingly, for no reason except I just read about it, there's on YouTube, Sarah Vaughan does a version. And I thought, well, I'd be interested in that. And whether it's a song or a scene, you want an artist to bring themselves to it. Don't ever think that it has to be what somebody else did it. And it is so Sarah Vaughan in terms of who she it was as a woman, an older woman in that moment, as a musician. It's astonishing. And she ends it really meaning, well, maybe next year, only with her extraordinary musicianship. But it is great literature, great plays, great songs benefit from having different people interpreting them.
We talk about cynicism. I don't think that's cynical. It's so sad, though, because you know... It's like me and the Bulls. Maybe next year they'll win, and I know they're not going to win next year either. But this is the stakes are a little higher. You know, this is love and searching for something you'll never find. Maybe next year. It's ultimately a very sad song. Do you agree?
It is very sad, but I love that it doesn't ask us to cry or. I mean, we will cry. Frequently it makes me cry, but it is so restrained in its tragedy, and that's music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim.
All right, here's another song, and in the obituary, and I've read this elsewhere, it's sort of considered Stephen Sondheim's song for himself, and it's called "Anyone Can Whistle." And it's he wrote it from the point of view of a woman who found it hard to love. This is a theme in Stephen Sondheim. It's hard to love. It's hard to find love. The world could be very cruel if you can't find love. So, again, I will do my best not to brutalize this, Bill. Anyone can whistle. That's what they say. Easy. Anyone can whistle any old day. Easy. It's all so simple. Relax, let go, let fly. So someone tell me why can't I? I can read Greek, easy. I could slay a dragon any old week, easy. What's hard is simple. What's natural comes hard. Maybe you can show me how to let go, lower my guard, learn to be free. Maybe if you whistle, whistle for me. Damn, what a riff. That, that riff, what's hard is simple. What's natural comes hard. is a priceless riff coming out of a writer's mind. But talk a little bit about in general that.
Well, not that I can swear to this, but that sounds to me as autobiographical as anything he ever wrote. You know, he knew he was a brilliant man, and he played to that. But I don't know that what we would call love came easily to him. And I once again, he's not begging us to feel sorry for him or her in this case, the character, but she's laying it out. Because he's such a precise lyricist and a precise composer. The tune is sort of minimal, you know, it's simple. Unlike this man's life, and it gets into your, it gets into our souls, it gets under our fingernails, by letting it be. And why, you know, these circumstances in which a character like that would say this, I think that's extraordinary. I mean, he's admitting to something, she's admitting to something that seems so hard to imagine.
You said something, I wrote it down. He knew he was a brilliant man, and he played to that. Tell me a little bit more what you meant by that.
Well, you know, he had fun with lyrics. He had fun with rhymes. He loved crosswords. He never apologized for that. Again, some of his critics thought I think would describe him as too clever by half. But for me, it always comes back to, what do you do with that clever? And when he's writing his own music, and even when he's not, it's to a purpose. It's to a purpose. We can take joy in those rhymes and those schemes, but it's not an end to it. There's still a story to be told. And I think he always understood story, and he always understood character. It was terribly important to him to delineate character.
When you say character, you mean the character of the people. You talk about the characters, the literal characters in his shows, that they would have to be consistent, that they have to be full-fledged. That's what I thought you were meant.
Yeah. I mean, A Little Night Music, all the music in the show is written in three, like Der Rosenkavalier, waltz tempo. And yet, you know, the way Petra sings, the maid, about, you know, her love affairs, and Send in the Clowns, and, I mean, you go through, and everyone is taken care of as a character. Because, and I've heard in interviews, I've heard him say how important that is to him. It's why actors want to do it.
Explain that. What do you mean? Why actors want to do it?
Well, do people do the people getting cast in a Sondheim musical? They're grateful. It's like getting cast in Shakespeare. It's like, okay, only I can screw this up, right? Because the writing's good.
Yeah, you got no one to blame if they screw it up, that's for certain.
Right, right.
This is from Assassins, and I don't know if you've ever staged it or have been in it. It's Assassins, about people who've assassinated presidents. Man, that kind of blew me away when the first time I saw it. This one here... I've thought about this. I just get your... this is, of course, the closing lines to the song that all the assassins gather on stage to sing. Everybody's Got the Right is the name of the song. Rich man, poor man, black or white, pick your apple, take a bite. Everybody just hold tight to your dreams. Everybody's got the right to their dreams. And it's such an aspirational lyric. And if you took it into a different context, you could like use it to sell products, you know, in merchandising, you know, on a TV campaign or something. But they're talking about people who are claiming this right to fulfill their dreams by killing prominent, powerful, popular, a lot of P's coming out of me, Bill, politicians, presidents. And I just, like, he's just turning everything upside down and inside out. And he does it. And again, like I said, take just the way the words flow. Pick your apple, take a bite. Pick your apple, take a bite. What a just a great combination right there. So first of all, I guess that's not cynical. How would you describe this particular song?
Harrowing, frightening. He's not afraid of fear. He's not afraid at all. I mean, Sweeney Todd. He's not afraid to scare us. It's interesting. Every day it seems like there's something new in a paper or magazine about him. And he recently, before he died, he talked about how that musical, in the age of being able to, you know, buy a semi-automatic at a 7-Eleven, has darkened. I mean, it has become more dangerous than it was intended to be.
Yeah, it's extremely relevant to this day. Absolutely. There was this shooting in Michigan. It wasn't a president, but five teenagers killed at a school in Michigan. And so, yeah, it's extremely relevant. And then finally, I'm going to, as long as I'm doing my favorite Stephen Sondheim, my absolute favorite is from Gypsy. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the poet at play here. And again, he did not write the music to Gypsy. I think it was Jules Stein wrote the music to Gypsy. But this is just so delightful, the way this flows out. Have an egg roll, Mr. Goldstone. Have a napkin, have a chopstick, have a chair. Have a spare rib, Mr. Goldstone. Any spare that I can spare, I'll be glad to share. Have a dish, have a fork, have a fish, have a pork. This is just, put your feet up, feel at home, have a smoke, have a Coke. Would you like to hear a joke? I'll have June recite a poem. Have a lychee, Mr. Goldstone. Tell me any little thing that I can do. Ginger peachy, Mr. Goldstone. Here's the, have a kumquat, have two. Everybody give a cheer. Santa Claus is sitting here. Mr. Goldstone, I love you. That is, of course, Mama Rose sucking up to Mr. Goldstone because she thinks that he can help advance the career of her daughter, and then she learns that he can't, and so she just if that's not cynical, I don't know. So she just throws him out, Bill Brown. But what a riff. Talk about that from an actor.
Well, look how much you're enjoying it. How much fun that is for us.
Yeah.
And you know, I read that in the theater, and I've never had anything to do. I've seen it a number of times. I saw it when Angela Lansbury do. I've seen a lot of them, and it's always thrilling to see. I saw Ife Butler to do it. It's so thrilling, but he wrote that when she sings, the orchestra gives her the note, and she goes, "Have an egg roll, Mr. Goldstone." And the audience erupts. It's such a great punchline. And he said, the problem then is, how do you keep the song going after the first line gets that big laugh? And so he did it by using his extraordinary inventiveness. He went off the charts in terms of, you know, what he did with his own clever lyrics.
That is so true. Yeah, it starts with a great line, and then how do you top that? Well, referring to not just one kumquat, but two is a good way to follow up a great line. I don't worry, got kumquat. It is. Oh, God. Every time I hear it, I just start laughing. Oh, God.
It's wonderful. And just the sheer joy of so many of his lyrics. When did clever become a bad thing? You know, as long as it's in the pursuit of truth. And I think he was always in the pursuit of truth.
I saw many years ago a movie that I don't know how many other people saw it. It was I don't think it did very well. It's called Camp, and I don't know how why I saw it, but whatever, I saw it. And it's a movie about a camp for teenagers who are musically talented or theatrically talented. And so it's sort of like Fame. I don't know if you ever saw the TV show, the movie Fame, which is set in a New York school for really talented kids, musically talented kids, theatrically talented kids. But this is a summer camp. They all go to the same summer camp, and they take singing, and they take dancing, and then they tell their lives. One's gay, one's straight, this, that, the other thing. This one has a crush on that one, blah, blah, blah. It turns into a soap opera. But somewhere in the middle of the show, in this movie, Stephen Sondheim, playing Stephen Sondheim, comes on. He's in the movie. And the whole point of it is that every kid in that camp, gay, straight, black, white, Hispanic, like, loves Stephen Sondheim. And it's like if Michael Jordan walked on to a basketball camp. And that's...
Right.
It's Stephen Sondheim.
Right.
And I want you to talk about that. Do you think, like, his, that ability to touch the heart of a kid who, they may not go on to a career like you have, Bill, in theater, but it's in their heart and soul. Do you think that essential Stephen Sondheim connection will exist now with kids, even that he's passed, he's gone, he's not creating new works anymore?
I do. I do. He's infected us all. I just was just this morning reading about the new production of Company in which Bobby is now B-O-B-B-I-E. It's a woman's story. And he had some reservations about it. But the woman who's directing it went to talk to him, and she had made a tape, a videotape of this workshop she'd done. And he watched it, but what really sold him was there was some tech guy working on the taping, and he heard him say as the tape was ending, "Wait a minute, I can't even see that. You mean a guy does this, really?" He couldn't, I mean, and that Sondheim went, okay, I can run with this. He couldn't even imagine such a thing after seeing a woman play Bobby. So I think he knew he was for the ages. He had every right to predict what he'd written, but he was interested in... All of us who do theater know, and particularly those of us who do a lot of classical theater, if it's not about us, if it's not about the people in those chairs and us up here on the stage and those of us, and when we direct, if we can't make it about us now, there's just no reason to do it. I mean, if you go to see a Hedda Gabler and the only reason she shoots herself is because she lives in the Victorian age, I've wasted my time. I have to find what motivates anyone to do what they do in a play, in a story, in a book, anything, and see how that translates into our own world, right? And he really understood that. Company is the only, most of the things he's done live in a, like there's no reason necessarily to switch up Assassins or... Little Night Music or Sweeney Todd, because they live in a period. Company wants to be in the present. And I got to direct a production of that that I really, again, something I listened to when I was a kid in West Virginia. What did I know? But it had to be about, I just couldn't imagine it as a period piece. So we didn't look like a period piece. And by and large, it found its way, except for the lyric, "I'll see you tomorrow or my service will explain." And, you know, for many people in the audience, well, don't know, half the audience. They didn't even hear the line, because what the hell does it mean to say your service will explain? That doesn't exist in our world. But other than that, he is timeless. He's a consummate artist, both lyrics and music, and creator of stories and plays.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bill, we've run out of time. I've got a whole bunch of other lyrics here, but we'll have to hold that off to a second Stephen Sondheim appreciation show. And I had it was so much fun reading Have an Egg Roll, Mr. Goldstone.
I'm going to call you up sometime and make you read me that. I love that. I love hearing you read that.
I did a good job with that one. I didn't do such a great job with Sending the Clowns, but I blame the fact that I could not read my own handwriting. As always, it's handwriting will do you in. Bill Brown, I didn't say I met Bill because he's my neighbor. One day I was walking by his house when he was giving away books, not even selling them. And he gave me a copy of Tennessee Williams' memoirs. Maybe the next show we have to do is about Tennessee Williams' memoirs, because it's a delightful book.
Okay, I absolutely enjoyed it.
Thank you for taking the time to come on my humble little show. And I really enjoyed talking Stephen Sondheim with
you. Thank you, Ben.
All right. That's Bill Brown. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.